This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, for the first time, a coalition of chiefs will be running in Vanuatu's election. They're hoping to change the way politics is done in the country.
We find that our traditional part of the constitution has not been maintained.
We'll also find out what the La Niña weather event means for the Pacific region. And we'll hear from the pilot who's become Vanuatu's first female captain of an ATR aircraft. And she has some advice for those wanting to dive into her slipstream.
Do not give up. If you have a goal, there will always be obstacles that will rise up out of nowhere. Just hit them head on. Don't give up.
All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, Fiji's Prime Minister has spoken out after his son was charged with multiple offences relating to assault and domestic violence in Australia. In a statement issued by the Fijian government, Frank Bainimarama said his son was not a member of the Fiji government and it was not a political or diplomatic matter. He said he and his wife Mary were deeply concerned and disturbed about the charges, and he highlighted his actions, condemning violence against women while in office. The charges laid against the PM's only son include assault, stalking and choking. ABC court reporter Kathleen Calderwood spoke about the case after court proceedings on Friday.
Raju Meli Bainimarama is facing 17 charges, most of which are domestic violence related. These include assault occasioning actual bodily harm, stalking and intimidation, and sharing an intimate image without consent. The 36-year-old is the only son of Fiji's current Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama. Now, there had been a suppression order on any reporting which would identify Mr. Bainimarama, but that today has been lifted by Magistrate Leanne Robinson here at the Windsor Court. Mr. Bainimarama's lawyer, Tony Edwards, argued that any publication could prejudice a future trial. He said that there had been publications already which had included defamatory allegations. He said in that article were defamatory allegations relating to other domestic violence allegations, which can certainly prejudice a trial. Mr. Bainimarama will rely on his good character in his defence. Now, Magistrate Leanne Robinson said there was nothing particularly unusual about the case, noting that unfortunately these kind of matters do come in front of the local court often, and she said she wasn't satisfied that there would be sufficient news interest to justify a non-publication order, saying that matters like this involving very high-profile people such as NRL players are regularly reported on. Now, Mr. Bainimarama is on bail. He's required to report daily to a Sydney police station and he has had to hand in his passport. His matter is due to be mentioned again in court on the 13th of October.
That was ABC court reporter Kathleen Calderwood speaking about the events on Friday. China, passport sales and the loss of traditional values are why Vanuatu's chiefs are saying they are running in next month's election. For the first time, Vanuatu's Malvatu Māori, or Council of Chiefs, is running candidates as part of an ambitious plan to take Parliament back. The snap election was called after Vanuatu's president controversially dissolved Parliament. And as Mackenzie Smith reports, the chiefs also want to make sure the political upheaval doesn't happen again.
Malvatu Māori already has an advisory role over Vanuatu laws involving cultural rights. The Council of Chiefs is made up of traditional leaders elected by their communities and villages to represent customary rights on a national stage. But fed up with what they see as a democracy in decline, the chiefs want to expand these powers by running for parliament. It's the first time the Council of Chiefs has decided to put forward members in elections. Chief Maurice Timatasso is running for Epi constituency.
The reason is that the politicians are acting and performing in a mixed culture here in Vanuatu, and more of the traditional values and principles of running a nation, we feel that it's neglected by politicians. And if not forgotten in many areas of running the government, we would like to see that the political government execute the services that the constitution requires.
Chief Tima Taso is one of 52 candidates the Mawhetū Māori plan to stand in the elections. It's an ambitious plan, and it's unclear whether they will be able to see it through in time for the polls on October 13. The candidates are running under the banner of the existing party, Vanuatu Indigenous Movement. Chief Tima Taso says one of their main priorities is to establish a Senate similar to Australia's, controlled by the Council of Chiefs, that would have oversight over any laws passed by Parliament. If elected, they plan to put this proposal to referendum. Chief Tima Taso says Vanuatu's traditions have been ignored in its politics. That's why he's running.
We find that our traditional part of the constitution has not been maintained. And the ownership of the nation, is losing. It's slowly losing its principles.
Another candidate is Chief Masing Wiliapia, who is running for Malekula constituency. He says the chiefs are intent on pushing back against China's influence in politics. One sticking point is a scheme that allows wealthy investors to buy citizenship, which led to the European Commission suspending a visa-free travel agreement with Vanuatu in March.
China is one of the countries that really pushing hard to get a lot of land in Vanuatu, and also selling of the passport to the different country is one of the issues, and these present days.
While the Mawhetū Māori's plans are ambitious, observers say the recent political turmoil has left voters discontented with the status quo. Vanuatu was pushed to call a snap election in August, 2 years before schedule, after Parliament was dramatically dissolved, just as a vote of no confidence was being planned against the Prime Minister. Anne Parkua, Chief Executive of the Vanuatu Human Rights Coalition, says the situation could give the chiefs critical inroads in their debut campaign.
The general public in general were not happy at all for what happened, in particular the dissolution of Parliament. So everyone's really hoping for a change, and what people want to see is, you know, some good leaders, traditional leaders.
She says the involvement of the chiefs could make a big impact on Vanuatu politics.
They meet every day to try and plan their campaigns to make sure that they get enough voters for their candidate. And if their candidate wins, this is going to be a big change, especially having the representative of chiefs in Parliament.
Parkua says churches are also putting candidates forward. Vanuatu's 300,000 registered voters go to the polls on October 13.
That was Pacific Beat reporter Mackenzie Smith with that report. We all know what that sound means. It's time to find out what's making headlines around the Pacific region. And I'm joined by Kyle Evans to do just that. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Now, let's head to Fiji, where bail has been denied for a Tennessee man charged with killing his wife. Oh, gosh, what's happened?
Yeah, this is that sort of high-profile case that's been unfolding now for the past couple of months. So Bradley Dawson, he faced court in Fiji last week and was denied bail as he awaits trial for that, really, really horrible incident that you just mentioned. So the Fiji judge actually went as far as to harshly reject three character witnesses who wrote letters supporting Bradley Dawson, who is currently accused of murdering his newlywed wife at a Fiji resort in July.
And did the judge have anything else to say?
Yeah, so he actually wrote a pretty scathing letter. So the judge actually pointed out that one of the references who was actually on bail himself in Fiji for assault charges. So probably not a great reference to use on that front. And it would be unsatisfactory for the pair to be basically residing together if bail was granted. He also said that under Fiji law, bail is actually void in cases of allegations of domestic violence, which Dawson's allegation very, very much is of that nature. So Dawson pleaded guilty to, pleaded not guilty to the murder of his wife back on September 1. And this is obviously all after she was found in a really bad way by staff at the Turtle Resort, having been badly beaten back in July. And it's understood that Dawson was found fleeing in a kayak later on.
Interesting. And that's from local reports, I imagine, local news sources. Yes, we will keep an eye to see what further reports come out of that. And now the United States President Biden has approved a disaster declaration in American Samoa. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is following those high surf winds and flooding that we reported on back in July. And the local government in American Samoa completed an assessment conducted territory-wide by officials, and it basically just, you know, rounded up the scale of the damage and just in what ways the island had suffered during those storms. The exact damage and the exact extent of it hasn't been released. However, American Samoa's governor is expected to provide a statement soon on that declaration.
And what exactly does that declaration do?
So basically money. So it's going to see federal funding available to the territory to provide certain non-for-profit organisations and just provide money for emergency work in the case of future events. And it will also fund the replacement of a number of facilities and repair work that needs to be carried out.
Yes, well, of course, American Samoa is a territory of the United States, so makes sense for them to provide some aid there as well. And now to some sporting news. There's been a World Cup Rugby League blow for Fiji, with several players pulling out. Why is that?
Yeah, potential huge blow, actually. So head coach Joe Rabelli has confirmed that several key players will not participate in the World Cup due to injury and other reasons. So this is reported by the Fiji Times. It was on the back page today. And the list of players, it's a star-studded one, unfortunately. So it includes forwards Daniel Safidi, Tariq Sims. It also includes Warriors winger Marcelo Montoya and even Knights forward Jacob Safiti. Kane Evans, I understand, is in doubt as well. And Corbin Sims and Regan Campbell-Gillard are yet to confirm. Campbell-Gillard is a bit of an interesting one, a very talented player, but he's currently in the midst of an NRL finals campaign. So he's got a preliminary final match coming up this weekend against the North Queensland Cowboys. And given the World Cup is on October 15. If he were to go through to the grand final, that's not a lot of turnaround between having to play a grueling season and the World Cup. So he might be in doubt on that front. So, yeah, pretty uncertain for Fiji at the moment. The team's going to depart for Australia on Wednesday for the PM's 13, which will be a bit of a warm-up for the World Cup. But it looks like they're going to have some personnel missing.
Yeah, that's a shame, but knowing Fiji rugby, they'll pull it together somehow, hopefully. Kane Evans there, is that a relative of yours, Kyle?
I'll just say yes. No, I wish he was, yeah.
Maybe a long-lost relative. Thank you so much, Kyle, for those stories from around the
Thanks,
region.
Thanks, Briaga.
That was Kyle Evans, not Kane, bringing us the latest stories from around the Pacific. Don't go anywhere, though, because we've got more stories from around the Pacific coming up. Very, very soon around the corner, we'll be chatting about La Niña. Have you ever heard about this? I understand it's a sort of weather phenomenon. And here in Australia, it's been called for a third summer in a row. They're saying that will bring extra rain for summer, which is, well, for me, not very good news. I like my summers dry and hot. But what does it mean for the Pacific? Well, very, very soon we'll be speaking to a weather expert in Samoa, I believe, to hear all about La Niña and what it means for the region. And today, preparations are underway for Queen Elizabeth II's funeral. It is to be held later today. But we'll be taking a closer look at calls by First Nations people around the region to cut ties with the British monarchy. They are saying now is the time to examine the relationship with Britain's former colonies and the monarch. You're listening to Pacific Beat right here on ABC Radio Australia. Australia's Bureau of Meteorology has officially declared a La Niña weather event for the third year in a row, But what does that mean for the Pacific? SPREP meteorology and climatology advisor Nimi Salesa joins us now to discuss. Welcome to Pacific Beat, Mr. Salesa.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this program.
Firstly, can you let us know, what does La Niña mean? What does this La Niña weather event mean?
Okay, so a La Niña weather event actually happens in the Pacific. It's the movement of warm water. The warm water in the Pacific Ocean strengthening the warmth in the western side of the Pacific, creating an imbalance of rainfall safer towards the west rather than to the central and the eastern Pacific.
Okay, so you said it is something that affects the Pacific. So do we know if a La Niña event has been made in the Pacific as well?
Yeah, a La Niña event is usually declared when the indicators that I monitored have achieved all the requirements or the thresholds. So, for example, for this La Niña, looking at the sea surface temperature on specific locations in the Pacific and looking at the atmospheric pressure and the changes that are happening, it's been declared that a La Niña is now in place. But the impact, how it will impact the Pacific in terms of the rainfall distribution, we will have to monitor that in the coming months.
Okay. So here in Australia, when we've been talking about a third La Niña in a row, we've been talking about wet summers, the potential of more floods that we have seen, these catastrophic floods hit particularly the eastern part of the country. Can we make similar predictions for the Pacific?
Yeah. So for the Pacific, the islands are spread across a large ocean. But for the western countries in the Pacific closer to Australia, they will be having similar impacts to Australia where there is high rainfall. For example, countries like Fiji, Vanuatu, parts of Solomon Islands, they will be receiving higher than normal rainfall. Whereas countries towards the equator, Northern Cook Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati, they will be experiencing below normal rainfall. And this is because of the drivers that bring rainfall to each of these countries.
Oh, interesting. So it sounds like in the lower western part of the Pacific, in those countries that you mentioned, Fiji, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, we'll be seeing an increase in rain and then elsewhere we'll be seeing, I guess, drier summers. Can that contribute to disasters or anything like that? Should we keep an eye on these now that La Niña has been called?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And while all the La Niñas are not the same every year, this particular La Niña, because it's been continuous for 3 years in a row, it will really have an impact on some of the Pacific Islands. And we have heard of the last few months, Kiribati declared a state of emergency because of below average rainfall. Now, with this declaration of another a possible La Niña or La Niña coming, they will continue to experience those below rainfall because all the rain that they would usually get during this time of the year will be all distributed to the Western Pacific. And similarly, those countries in the Western Pacific will have to be very careful in terms of, you know, when there is a low pressure system or a tropical cyclone, because we are now heading into cyclone season. This can easily create a flooding event in the wet season.
Oh, dear. So the cyclone season, as usual, will still come around, but can be exacerbated by these floods as well? So cyclones are still, you know, have a potential to hit the Pacific?
Yes, I mean, And studies have been undertaken to show that cyclone events during La Niña period are favored towards the western side of the Pacific. And given that we have gone through, you know, a long period of above average rainfall. It is not only during the cyclones, but I think more importantly during the low pressure, when we have a low pressure system hanging around our areas. This during this time, and we have seen this, in the 2012 flooding in Fiji, or even the flooding that happened in 2020, where it didn't require a tropical cyclone to bring those kind of devastation. And it's the same for countries like Vanuatu, New Caledonia, Solomon Islands. They have to be vigilant about flood-related disasters.
Yes, indeed. If you are just joining us here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, we're talking about the effects of La Niña on the Pacific, this weather event, which, as we're hearing, is predicting wetter summers for the Western Pacific and drier or lower than average rainfall for parts of the rest of the region. And to talk through what that all means, we're joined by SPREP meteorology and climatology advisor Nimi Salesa. Nimi, this is the third year in a row that La Niña has been declared. Why is that? Is this something to do with climate change, or is it to be expected?
It has happened. It's not unique. It's rare, but it's happened before. We had the last event, a triple event that happened was from 1998 to 2001. There was one from 1973 to 1976 and one from 1954 to 1957. I think depending on the condition of the ocean and the atmosphere, these events can happen in a row and very devastating for those countries that have, that have direct impact. And we've seen this, for example, for the La Niña event that happened in 2012, while there was flooding in Fiji, there was drought in countries like Tuvalu, where aid has to be and water has to be distributed to them. While it is rare, it is not unique. It has happened in the past, and it's part of the natural climate system.
Okay, so it's a natural climate system. So there's nothing we can do, I guess, to stop it, is it? How is La Niña actually caused?
Yeah, nothing much we can do. I think we have now technologies that are able to forecast in advance when this is happening. When it happened in, I think, the 1997-98 El Nino caught everyone by surprise. Not everyone by surprise, but brought a lot more awareness to this event. And since then, the National Met Services have been able to, work together. We have now a consortium of institutions in the Pacific called the Regional Climate Center Network, made up of science institutions in the Pacific, including SPREP and other regional organizations, that we are able to provide this information in advance to the National Met Services to warn their sectors and their communities. So I think information is able to be provided in advance for everyone to take heed and to take action.
Yes, and I wanted to ask you what that action should be. What should people do knowing now that La Niña has been declared?
Okay, so I think the first thing is to listen to your National Met Service, the National Meteorological Services in your country. They will be able to work with various sectors, for example, with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Water, and they'll be able to give specific sector advice for what you should do, either in the community or in various countries. And like I said, we know the general impact that they will have in each of these countries. But for detailed sector-specific advice, you will need to consult with the national governments and your relevant national agencies.
Yes.
As well as the National Disaster Management Office.
Yes, yes, indeed. With those higher risks of flooding and the impacts of cyclones coming into cyclone season, that is very important. And finally, Nimi, I wanted to ask, when can we expect the impacts of La Nina to be seen? Do we have a date or a month when this will happen?
I think it's already happening. I mean, it's already been declared. It will probably need for some countries, it might need probably a low pressure system to trigger, you know, high rainfall. For others, they will probably be experiencing slowly the low below average rainfall, which over a period of time, say 3 to 4 months, if they are entirely dependent on rainwater, then they will be experiencing shortage of water. So I think rather than wait to see the impact of the La Nina, it is best to contact the national agency, national disaster management offices, to start getting yourself prepared for the upcoming wet or cyclone season.
Yes, that's very good advice. Always better to prepare. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Nimi.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to provide information.
Yes, from very, very important information there about the La Nina weather event. That was SPREP Meteorology and Climatology Advisor Nimi Salesa there speaking to us about it.
ABC Radio Australia will be broadcasting the state funeral of Queen Elizabeth II live on Monday from 8 p.m. PNG time. As the Commonwealth and the world remembers Queen Elizabeth II, join us on this historic event and commemorate the life of Britain's longest-serving monarch. Tune in to the Queen's funeral on Monday from 8 p.m. PNG time, live on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. And millions are preparing to pay their respects to Queen Elizabeth II at a funeral in London today. And here in Australia, the Queen's death is being marked by a day of mourning, which has been declared for Thursday. But First Nations people are speaking up about the pain, suffering and marginalisation they endured under the Britain's monarchy. Clayton Simpson-Pitt says Indigenous Australians are simply fed up with the monarchy.
While they're mourning their queen, we're mourning our people. We're mourning our old people. We've had enough, and it is an insult to declare at the click of a finger a day of mourning on the 22nd of September. We've been calling for a day of mourning since 1938, and while they mourn their queen, we will mourn our people. It's not as such anger. Perhaps we're more just fed up as a people. We've been putting up with this for well over 230 years now. Come on, guys. Let's look at who we are as a people, who we are as a nation, and really look at moving forward. Let's look at decolonising from Britain. The United Nations have told us, you need to decolonise Australia. You need to cut off the colonial shackles. This will be the time to do it.
That was Clayton Simpson-Pitt, elected Gomeroi native title applicant. Parts of Australia were first colonised in the 1700s, where Indigenous land was claimed for Britain under the name and instruction of King George III. He was Queen Elizabeth II's ancestor. When Indigenous Australian parliamentarian Lydia Thorpe took her oath in office last month, she raised her fist above her head in protest. She also labelled the Queen as a colonising queen.
So many of my people have been murdered by the system and the colonial regime here. I felt that I was kneeling to the murderer. And that was the most demoralising moment, apart from the last time I did it. It's demoralising to have to confront the very thing that buried our babies into the ground and kicked their heads off, or removed over 20,000 Aboriginal children from their homes.
During Queen Elizabeth's 70-year reign, there was some talk of cutting ties with the monarchy and becoming a republic in some countries, but it never really took off. But now, with her death and the ascension of her less popular son, Charles, those calls are growing. New Zealand Te Pate Māori co-leader Debbie Nawera Packer is a supporter of the republic movement.
If we can't address the negativity and the impacts of colonisation now, then when? Do we wait for Prince William or Prince William's children? The reality is, no one alive doesn't understand the true impacts of colonisation, the displacement it does to peoples. Previously, it was accepted. Now it's not. It's dehumanising, and it needs to stop.
King Charles has hosted a reception of world leaders at Buckingham Palace ahead of the funeral of Queen Elizabeth today. US President Joe Biden, French President Emmanuel Macron, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese were among the guests. You may have heard of the term breaking the glass ceiling. Well, one Ni Vanuatu woman is literally soaring high above rooftops.
My name is Stephanie Tarileo. I am from Vanuatu and I am a female pilot.
Miss Tarileo recently became the country's first female captain of an ATR aircraft. She tells reporter Marion Farr all about how the dream began.
Growing up, my dad was a pilot. I would always see him in uniform, always see the airport, always see planes and travel. So it kind of like just led me to want to be a pilot just like dad. Going to school, it was like, oh yeah, let's just follow dad's footsteps. It'll be easier that way.
Was it easy though, as a woman?
Oh no, it wasn't.
Tell me about the barriers that you faced as a woman and just in general on this career path that you decided to pursue.
I thought it would be more gender-based, like more male-dominated, but luckily I went to New Zealand to do my aviation studies there. The atmosphere was more different than what I expected, so it wasn't as hard for me to, how do I say, break barriers.
So you went off and studied aviation in New Zealand and then you returned to Vanuatu to work and fly planes around the country, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was that like, yeah, your early career flying planes? Tell me about that.
It was pretty different because in New Zealand during training, you just flew over like huge masses of land. Like you wouldn't cross the sea as much. Coming back to Vanuatu, you'd like island hop all the way. So it was really different seeing more water than land. And it was really exciting. Like I'd be like, oh yeah, I've seen more than 10 islands in just one day. And all my friends would be like, oh, we're so jealous. It's like, yeah, that's the job.
Yeah, well, Vanuatu is such a beautiful place and I imagine being able to see it from the air every day just be stunning.
It's really, really beautiful.
What is your favourite part of the role?
Oh, I don't know. All of it, I guess. The sunsets at night. It's way nicer up in the air.
Now, you were recently officially named the first female ATR captain for Air Vanuatu. Tell me, how did that feel?
Oh, it's surreal, eh? I don't know if it's real or not. I still can't believe that I'm the captain of the ATR and first female in the country is such a big deal. It's hard. I don't know what to say. It's surreal.
I can hear in your voice of how exciting it is, and I imagine it must have been such a proud moment for your parents as well. Tell us, what is an ATR aircraft for those who don't know?
An ATR is a turboprop, so a propeller, two-engine propeller aircraft. There's two types. There's one that can carry 42 passengers and a longer one that can carry 72 passengers.
And as captain of the aircraft, what does your job entail?
Entails a lot of things. Basically, I am the last person to give their say, decision-making-wise. just to safely take passengers from A to B, and that's a really big responsibility.
Are you flying internationally or mostly just around Vanuatu?
We do regional flights as well. We go to Fiji and New Caledonia.
So, Stephanie, you've obviously been on a big journey to get to where you are. What's your advice to other young Ni Vanuatu and Pacific Islander women?
My advice would be do not give up. Do not give up. If you have a goal, there will always be obstacles that will rise up out of nowhere. Just hit them head on. Don't give up. Keep your eyes on the goal and you will eventually get there. It may take longer, but you will get there eventually. Just don't give up.
Vanuatu's first female captain of an ATR aircraft, Stephanie Taraleo, speaking there with Marion Farr. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Sports cheering is a popular sport throughout Australia and internationally. There's even been a push to get it into the Commonwealth Games as well. Recently, a Welsh shearer, Lloyd Rees, broke a British record, shearing 902 lambs in 9 hours. He explains to Megan Hughes how it all played out.
A shearing record, 9 hour day format, so 5 till 5 with a 12-hour day, 9 hour shearing. There's a 2 hour run and then 4 hour and 45 minute runs. And I sheared 902 lambs in 9 hours. It's the most ever done in a record format. There's people have done over 900 lambs before around the world, but never under in an actual record attempt.
That's pretty exciting. So it's a world record. It's not just one for the UK.
It's the most sheep ever shorn in a record attempt, but it's not actually a world record because they didn't quite meet the criteria. They had enough wool weight, but they need a little bit of wool on their heads to pass for world record lambs, and they didn't have that.
Why did you want to do this in the first place?
A bit of a test for myself, really. I've been shearing for over 10 years now, and I just wanted to, my traveling days are starting to wind down, so I thought I'd like to go out with a bit of a bang. Yeah, it was a good opportunity to really push myself, test myself, see what I could achieve. And also we raised a lot of money for the air ambulance and for Parkinson's, which are two charities that I'm quite passionate about, really.
And you said that you've worked in a few different countries, not just the UK?
I've spent 10 seasons working in New Zealand, actually. Just completed my 10th one now in February. I've also been to Norway once, and I've sheared in Switzerland quite a few times. I'm not sure exactly how many times, but yeah, I've been quite a few times in Switzerland as well.
What now? What are you going to do after you beat this record? Are you got any plans for another one or...?
Yeah, I'm probably going to concentrate more now on the show shearing aspect. You know, trying to win some national titles, hopefully, and things like that. Yeah, that was my passion really before the record. So I'll probably change it back up and head in that direction again now.
And I imagine that'll just take you everywhere.
The World Championships is the dream, and like recently, it's been New Zealand, it's been France. Going back a few years, it's been Norway. So, you know, like the next one's in Edinburgh. It gets you around the world, doesn't it? So, yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Welsh shearer Lloyd Rees. David Brooker is involved with Sport Shear Australia and is on the World Record Committee. He explains how sport shearing works and how Australia is preparing for the World Championships.
Well, World Records is completely different from show shearing. Show shearing is obviously quality. Speed, of course, and quality, and it's putting people to the test. There's no doubt about that. We're a world record. We rate the sheep. We assess them in a standing, only out the back in a standing equation. We do make sure that the sheep isn't injured and they go out to a standard, but it's not the same as what you would be judging for if you're a show shearing judge or a sport shear judge. It's a different. Yeah, you got to, it's just different mindset. These kids that do world records, male or female, they put themselves to the test. They're superhuman.
What's the most amazing thing that you've seen as a judge?
Obviously, you know, when you start talking 9-hour days, you don't hear of that much anymore. New Zealanders have had that in their shearing sheds for a while now. They're probably going back to a few 8-hours and maybe a few 9-hour days, but I don't think it's sort of changed. But it's still a record to be had, and you've got all types of records, a two-stand strong wool, a merino ewe, and there's weather records, there's lamb records, there's a lot of different records people can go for. You know, how many stands, you know, but obviously, you're flying an international judge, normally goes to adjudicate it alongside the country where the record is set. They'll have their own judges as well, so we do mix our judges up a fair bit. We fly them around the world when there's one on. These guys, they just, and girls, they superhuman, have to be well prepared for it. It's a mammoth effort to get over the line, and a lot of them achieve it. And obviously, there's sometimes they don't quite make the grade. So, and that's just any record to be taken on.
The World Championships have been on hold a bit because of COVID. Is there any plans for them to be back up and running soon?
In the sports year world, you know, obviously once again that's the shearing competition, wool handling competition, and blade shearing competition around the world. We're setting up for July next. The national or the world shearing titles are in Scotland, in Edinburgh, in July next year. So, anything in Australia at the moment, we're preparing our teams, the state teams, to go to Bendigo in October, and then we'll select our two machine shearers, our two wool handlers, and our two blade shearers, and with a couple of judges and a manager. They'll be off in July next year over to Scotland, one of the biggest shearing competitions. Well, it'll be the world shearing competition since 2000. Well, when did we last stop? 2019 was our last one, I think.
That was David Brooker, who's involved with Sports Shear Australia and is on the World Record Committee, speaking there with Megan Hughes. And that about brings us to the end of Pacific Beach, a reminder of our top stories. First, we started with Fiji's Prime Minister speaking out after his son was charged with multiple offences relating to assault and domestic violence in Australia. We also looked to Vanuatu, where for the first time, Vanuatu's Malvatu Māori, or Council of Chiefs, is running candidates as part of an indigenous plan to take parliament back in next month's election. We also looked at what La Niña, this weather event, means for the Pacific. We heard that it'll be bringing extra rain and not enough rain for other parts of the Pacific. Do listen back to that one. You can find that story and heaps of others on our website. That's abc.net.au/Pacific. Have a lovely day.